Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all here this evening. And I'm very pleased to be able to introduce Professor Robin Mansell. Robin joined the LSE in January 2001. She holds the Dixon's Chair in New Media and the Internet. The chair is endowed by Dixon's Group. Sir Stanley Carmes built Dixon's into the leading UK-based group specialising in the sale of high-technology consumer electronics, personal computers, and photographic equipment. We're very grateful for Stanley's commitment to supporting world-class research and teaching here at the school in the new media area. We welcome here, I think sitting in the lecture hall, David Longbottom and Elizabeth Fagan from Dixon's. This lecture marks the launch of the Dixon's Chair. Robin is working with a whole number of departments in the LSE, which taken together form this network media at the LSE. It spans departments including information systems, sociology, social psychology, economics, law, gender institute, geography, and government. So you see, it goes a long way across the LSE. There are already 120 MSc students and some 15 PhD students in this overall program. Some of the themes are democracy, the digital economy, literacies, culture and community, and ethics. The aim is for the holder of the Dixon's Chair to develop our research and teaching capacity in the new media area. In teaching, Robin is directing the new MSc in New Media, Information and Society. Robin spent 12 years at the Science Policy Research Unit at Sussex University. So we're very pleased to be able to attract her to the LSE. It wasn't easy to do. We had to prize her away from her previous milieu. There in Sussex, she was at various times Director of the Information Networks and Knowledge Research Centre, SPRU Director of Research, and Director of Graduate Studies. She built a world-class centre of expertise on the social and economic impact of information and communications technologies. Robin's latest book is called Mobilising the Information Society, Strategies for Growth and Opportunity, written with Ed Steinmuller of Sussex, which came out in 2000. And this explains why policymaking for the new media is an uncertain and difficult task in a globalising world. That is for sure. The title of her lecture this evening is New Media and the Power of Networks. Please welcome Robin Mansell.
Thank you, Professor Giddens. Good evening to all of you from me as well. I'd like to welcome all of you, and especially those of you from the Dixon's Group. I'd like to really welcome those of you who I know who have actually come from quite a distance to be here tonight. And I'd also like particularly to welcome the students who are here, and particularly students who are just starting their first term at the LSE. It's my first teaching term here as well, and so I know just a little about what you might be experiencing. It's really exciting, but it's really exhausting too, I know this. My subject for this evening is the new media and the power of networks. It's about people and our abilities to make choices about how we want to live our lives. And the significance of the new media and the power of networks? Well, I believe that it is absolutely essential for policymakers, the business world, and citizens to wake up to an important and often neglected way that the internet is influencing our lives. The existence of the internet is enhancing the power of people who have the ability to make the best use of it. Because of this power of the global networks, I think that it's absolutely essential to move beyond concerns about issues like internet access and social exclusion. This might surprise some of you who know me, because you know I'm almost always on about social exclusion and internet access. But tonight I want to go beyond that. What we need to do is to link discussions about the new media and the power of networks to discussions about human rights. I want to show this evening that this link is crucially important. It's important because it is essential for the possibilities to exist for many, many, many more people to acquire particular types of abilities in the so-called information age. The new media are permeating all kinds of social networks, as you well know. But the widespread absence of the abilities to make sense of the worlds of online spaces and offline places that are being created by our global networks means that, at least in my view, there is a very, very strong case for a rights-based approach to new media policy. This evening, I want to focus mainly on the positive enabling power of networks in the new media. But the events of September the 11th do underline the need to say something about the disabling and destructive power of networks. I think that the sorrow we feel for those who have lost people they love, and that we have for people whose poverty and hunger is now exacerbated by new fears, is being mediated by information produced by the traditional media, organizations, and within the electronic spaces of the internet. It's increasingly difficult to make sense of this information. This isn't just because of the quantity or even its content. It's because it's very unclear, in many cases, what the provenance of this information is. This is not a new problem, but it is a problem that I think we must take seriously, and we must do so by extending and deepening the critical discourse about the origins and validity of information provided by the internet. This is necessary if there is to be some sort of informed public debate about terrorist acts and the actions of others, and many other social problems within the fabric of the global environment. People often claim that globalization and the spread of new media like the internet are disrupting society. Many think that the spread of these networks is making it very difficult to anticipate change, and indeed for any type of organization to govern effectively. The dilemma over how to tackle the terrorist use of older and new media and communication networks without infringing upon established rights and freedoms is dramatic evidence of the seriousness of this problem. Is it possible, then, to imagine how the contradictory power of these networks can be employed in ways that really are positively enabling for the majority of people and for society as a whole? I think that it is, but that it's only possible to do so and to formulate effective policy if we connect concerns about the new media and the power of networks to bigger issues of human rights and social development. Most of our policies are encouraging a situation in which only a small minority of people have or are able to acquire the ability to use the new media in ways that strengthen their abilities for making choices about how to live their lives. For example, the abilities to make choices about treatments for illness, about the exploration of new jobs and skills, or even just about searching for like-minded people. For those who are unable to use the new media in these ways, far too much human potential is being lost. This will, if it does not already, infringe upon people's human rights to participate in building a constructive society. It follows that there are grounds for policy action. Action is necessary to ensure that the new media provide the kinds of electronic spaces where people can acquire new abilities to assist them in managing their daily lives. What abilities am I talking about? I'm not talking simply about acquiring skills to get on the internet, nor am I simply talking about the technical ability to use the World Wide Web, discussion lists, or email. I'm not speaking about the abilities for using most of the new e-government or e-commerce or e-everything else services that we hear so much about. The abilities I'm speaking about this evening are of very profound importance. These abilities, or as Professor Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, calls them, these capabilities are the abilities to discriminate between alternative choices, and this is something that must be learned. This learning alters our cognitive capacities to recognize and to evaluate choices and alternatives. These capabilities are the foundation of the freedoms that allow individuals' needs to be met, needs like remaining healthy and interacting with others. If new media spaces can be developed in ways that augment people's capabilities of this kind, that Professor Sen has considered, then there is a public obligation to consider how it must be done and to take action when other forms of initiatives fall short. If policy does not begin from this starting point, the likelihood is that a minority of people will use our global networks to help themselves to acquire the capabilities to discriminate between alternative choices. If the majority of people do not have these capabilities to deliberate about the things that they value, and the new media are a contributing factor to this, then something must be done. More policies to reduce the so-called digital divide, that is, the gaps in access to the internet, are not the answer in this case. What I'm talking about is not particularly related to the uneven diffusion of telephones, computers, and internet access. Instead, it's related to the need to create electronic internet spaces that facilitate the acquisition of capabilities in Sen's meaning of the term for the majority of people. This requires a radical step in new media policy. And what I want to show is that current trends in the development of the internet do not favor the creation of the types of internet spaces that are needed, at least by the majority of people. This is because the bias of new media developments favors the minority. This bias favors those who are best positioned to live their lives in an intensely technologically mediated world. To explain this, I'm going to ask and do my best to answer four questions. First, why should we be concerned about the internet and what I'm referring to as the power of networks? Second, is there a case for a change in policy to ensure that people have the right to acquire certain essential capabilities for living in the internet age? Third, why can't we leave it to teachers to worry about this? And fourth, are there grounds for optimism that the emphasis of policy will shift to a focus on capabilities for living effective lives in the internet age? So, if I can work the technology. First question. Why should we be concerned about new media and the power of global networks like the internet? Some would say that the dot-com craze is over. In fact, many said that at the symposium this morning and this afternoon. In my short 10 months at the LSE, I've already become an anachronism. At the very least, the title of my chair should be rethought. Well, it will surprise few of you who know my work to learn that I think the problem of the power of networks is an enduring one. Professor Roger Silverstone, who directs the Media and Communications Program here at the LSE, gives us a really straightforward answer to my question. We study the media, he says, because we need to understand how they contribute to the exercise of power in society within the established political processes and outside them. Most of the attention of media and communication policy is on markets and regulation, or on access to technology, or on the costs of reducing social exclusion. But much more is at stake. This is the necessity for many more people to acquire new forms of capabilities, for recognizing and making choices of the kind Sen is thinking of, and that Roger calls media literacies. media literacies are crucial. They go far beyond knowing how to read and understand what we hear and see in the traditional media or by accessing the internet. New media literacies are crucial because, as Manuel Castell says in his book, The Internet Galaxy, which was launched here at the school yesterday, the internet is the fabric of our lives. If people living within this fabric are to have the freedoms to achieve the lives they want to live, then they must be able to acquire the necessary media literacies. Without the ability to achieve these literacies, problems of alienation, poverty and ignorance, and indeed of terrorism will worsen. This is because relatively few individuals will have the capabilities to improve their own lives or to express their opinions about what they value. Castells argues that information strategies have become the most effective means for the exercise of power on the world stage. Democratic processes constructed around capabilities for media literacy are essential if people are to achieve the things that they value or to exercise their power in a responsible way. When electronic information is embedded in and is mediating so many people's lives, some form of control of the power of networks like the internet is, as Castells says, perhaps the most fundamental political issue of our time. Issues around control of media and communication networks are not new, it has to be said. Raymond Williams, a major British scholar in the field, and many before and since, have linked issues of control and the structure of and content of the older media and the new media to questions of the organization of society. But John Thompson's work at Cambridge more recently suggests that there still is a profound neglect of how specific forms of media, including the new internet spaces, are influencing the way that people choose to live their lives. Much of today's discussion about the internet is not about how or even whether the use of the new media for email or to create websites might augment people's capabilities to change their lives. In fact, discussions about the new media are often completely divorced from any consideration of the conditions of people's lives or of their freedoms to create positive changes in their lives. Thompson talks about, and I quote, the double bind of mediated dependency. Just the sort of phrase that gets academics into trouble, I think. Do we really need this complicated jargon? But what he says is important. By this, I think he means that just when our processes of forming identities are being enriched by the new media's vast symbolic content, we're actually becoming far more dependent on networks that are beyond our control. The vast majority of people have no say over how the new media networks or their contents are being developed, over how they're structured and what they cost to use, or indeed over whether they are consistent with enabling most people to acquire the capabilities for living effective lives. Thompson suggests that mediated experiences associated with the new media are biased in various ways, but most importantly, they tend to disempower local forms of political organization. They make traditional forms for democratic dialogue very difficult to sustain. And he argues that a new form of publicness is required. But like Jürgen Habermas's earlier advocacy of the need to create spaces for public discourse, and like the pleas of those who are concerned with the potential for what is often called deliberative democracy, theory stops short of specifying what can be done to create some new forms of publicness. There is, of course, the policy strategy of regulation in an attempt to reduce the concentration of the media and communications industries. And I'm not going to go on about that, because I think what is necessary is much more attention to other aspects of new media policy. Attention needs to be given to issues of democracy and to concerns about sustainable social development, and specifically to how policy can foster internet spaces where many more people can acquire the capabilities they need for functioning in a highly technologically mediated world. We need to consider questions about new media policy, democracy, social development, and distributional equity together. If the new media networks do not favor environments that enable the majority of people to choose how to improve their lives, then policy is needed to support networks and applications that do favor this. In effect, policy should ensure that new media are developed in a way that creates the possibility for individual self-development, or to use another term, self-actualization. It's very difficult to move this argument to the center of the policy agenda. This is mainly because new media policy is not concerned at its core with people's rights in the internet age. It is true that many do now recognize the importance of global networks. The American economist Paul Romer argues that one reason why these networks matter is that in a knowledge economy, hardware, software, and what he calls wetware, or human capital, are the replacements for raw materials and certain sorts of workers. He says that new capabilities are needed for managing electronic business networks. The prospects for economic growth depend on being able to reap the benefits of organizing business around networks. But the principal focus of discussions about the new, the knowledge, or the digital economy is on growth and technology. It is not on distributional equity, human rights, and social development. In discussions about the information society, attention often is given to issues beyond the potential for economic growth. And in most cases, the focus is on the development of capabilities for building social or human capital. I've contributed to some of this work in my before I came here when I was at SPRU. My students and my colleagues and I have investigated the technological capabilities for designing all kinds of electronic services. We've looked at the skills of web designers and at why people are very reluctant to share digital information. We've examined what we call institutional capabilities, such as those for making policy and for regulating in areas like intellectual property, electronic commerce, and broadcasting. This work often leads to interesting debates about internet-related skills and training, but it hardly ever leads to a discussion about human rights. To make this link, we need a different starting point. We need to join up discussions about how skills are acquired for functioning in the knowledge economy with a debate about other capabilities people are entitled to acquire in a humane society. And this brings me to my second question. Is there a case for a change in new media policy to ensure that people have the right to acquire certain capabilities? Professor Sen's work offers a very helpful way of thinking about rights and entitlements. It can be applied with very practical results in the new media field. He calls for an examination of capabilities as a basic human right. In developing his idea of capabilities, Sen writes about functionings. Functionings, he says, are what people may value doing or being. Functionings may be very basic, like being free from hunger or illness. They can be very complex, such as being able to participate in the life of a community or having self-respect. Sen argues that capabilities are the functionings that an individual is actually able to achieve. Capabilities are the underpinnings of the freedoms to construct meaningful lives. When we apply this capabilities approach to the new media, we have to ask, what capabilities are available to an individual to acquire? Answers to this question requires that we evaluate the capabilities that any person is entitled to, and this is the issue for policy. As Sen argues, this evaluation is an exercise in social choice. It requires public discussion and democratic understanding and acceptance. These social choices are not just about capabilities for encouraging social or human capital development, the way they were usually discussed in the information society debates. As Sen points out, capabilities of this kind emphasize the capabilities of human beings for augmenting the production of goods and services, and mainly concerned with the problem of growth of the growth potential of the digital economy. They're concerned with how people can become more productive and efficient. But Sen's capabilities approach is different. It's about, and I quote, the substantive freedom of people to live the lives they have reason to value and to enhance the real choices that they have. His approach starts from a concern for human well-being. It starts from a view that choice and the freedom to act are essential. Sen rejects the neoclassical proposition that human welfare can be served best only by market exchange. He rejects the idea that the outcomes of market exchanges produce an adequate measure of well-being. In short, he develops a needs-based approach to individual entitlements. Professor Nicholas Garnham of the University of Westminster has applied this approach to issues of telecommunication access. He points out that decisions about people's entitlements have nothing to do with merit or absolute wealth. The metric for deciding who gets what is not money or utility. Instead, it is whether people are entitled to develop the capabilities to achieve what they value in their lives. This idea is similar to the idea of the concept of self-actualization, the term I used earlier. Abraham Maslow developed this idea some time ago in reference to people's needs, functions, and motivations. Maslow said that people who lack food, safety, and love and esteem, they'll want food in the first instance more strongly than they'll want anything else. But when physiological needs are relatively satisfied, a new set of needs come into play for stability, security, protection, freedom from fear, anxiety, and chaos. Like Sen, Maslow talked about being. He wrote about the importance of the individual's capacity for growth. Now, I recognize that there are problems in their emphasis on the self rather than the self in relation to the other, but both Maslow and Sen give central place to the acquisition of cognitive capabilities and to learning. In fact, Maslow argued that any blocking of the use of these capabilities is a threat to the satisfaction of the basic needs of human beings. If the organization of the internet's fabric is blocking people's capabilities for meeting their needs, then there is a fundamentally important issue for policy. Predictions that the internet's capacity for improving connectivity will create, that it will create profound social change are probably not incorrect. They do suffer from hyperbole, as you all know. And amnesia is often the condition of some internet pundits who forget that the offline world of things and human beings still matters. But the fact that the internet is spanning the world and that it is providing an open space for learning make it an imperative, I think, that we check whether its development is threatening people's rights to acquire the capabilities they need for living their lives. Since Gutenberg, the technical tools for communications and the media have been influencing the lives of human beings. There was a hope that yesterday's media would help people to learn in ways that would enable the majority of people to improve their social and economic condition. Now the same hopes, at least in some people's minds, are being pinned on the internet. My contention this evening is that such hopes will not be fulfilled without a fundamental shift in the focus of policy to the question of rights and entitlements. We must work out what the entitlements of individuals are in relation to the new media. The problem is that we don't have a basis for shaping the new media that favors their use by the majority of people in ways that would enable them to develop their own potential for acquiring the necessary cognitive capacities. People must be entitled to make choices about their lives. But to make these choices within the internet fabric, they need to acquire the capabilities that are relevant to the internet age. Without these, they will not have the freedoms that are achievable by the minority of people. And as Nicholas Garnham suggests, we need to examine barriers to the freedoms of people that the ongoing development of new media is creating. And I think this is a very helpful suggestion. Sen goes on to suggest that communication in modern times requires a basic education and training. And he says that in a globalizing world, there is a profound need for social justice and for people to take part in decisions if and when they choose. The capabilities such as reading and writing are important, but so too are the capabilities for being well-informed and able to participate freely in society. But the problem is that we don't have specific details about what policy measures would encourage the broadest development of these capabilities for making informed choices in a world where the power of new media is becoming so pervasive and profound. This is the issue I want to tackle next, because without specific details, it's impossible to see what this capabilities approach might mean for policy action. The emphasis on acquiring the capabilities for making social choice becomes yet another exhortation for reasoned public dialogue, unless it's tied to action. And this is the third issue, third question that I want to address. Why not leave it to teachers to worry about these capabilities? If we want to go beyond exhortations about that the new media should encourage reasoned public dialogue, we do need to strengthen the capabilities of many more people, certainly more than children and teenagers, to participate in society in ways that they choose. We cannot leave the worries about these capabilities and freedoms only to teachers and formal education. All of us have to reconstruct the very core of our understanding of what the internet is and what the new media mean for people's freedoms. Without guidance from social activists and interests, teachers are not in a better position than others to guide this process. Formal education is sadly rarely organized to encourage dialogue about entitlements, human rights, and social purposes. If we are concerned about equity and poverty reduction around the world, then we must examine how the internet, as a vast space for learning, can contribute to the goal of improving equity and to enhancing the freedoms of people. We must be concerned about this if we want to understand the positive and the destructive power of networks. At present, the development of internet websites and the use of email is contributing in some limited ways to strengthening people's capabilities. It is true that a minority of people are benefiting from internet-based discussions and its vast information resources, but the new media policy priority must be to enable many more people to benefit. And I'm going to demonstrate that the general trend of internet development is not consistent with this goal, and that this is not simply a problem of how to improve access to the internet or even its contents. And in order to do this, I think we need a little bit of empirical evidence. Using an internet search engine, it's possible, as you will all know, to discover huge numbers of what we call information intermediaries. These are the sites that all of you visit on the website, on the World Wide Web. And when we do this, in industry sectors from publishing to automobiles and from insurance to banking, there are dozens of websites. The owners of these sites generally claim that they support local and global commercial transactions. Here at the LSE and with colleagues at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex, we've analyzed over 350 of these websites just recently in horticulture and garment sectors. The results show two things very clearly. First, the vast majority of these commercial sites are walled sites. They are for members only. Second, even when they're open to anyone who can connect, they are not always what they purport to be. They may claim to offer business services like logistics or help for producers to meet industry standards for quality or environmental protection, or even help in verifying the identities of firms. But perilously few actually do this in the ways that they claim. The growing pressures to commercialize the internet are creating an incentive to close up this open public space so that it is more secure and reliable for business services. Some argue that as the internet develops, it will cease to be a simple end-to-end network that is potentially available to all to support their business, research, and everyday life activities. This topic is exercising the minds of quite a number of technical experts, legal people, and some economists. They worry about what the balance between open and closed public spaces will be, and this is a very important issue. However, tonight I want to focus on a parallel issue. It is central to our consideration of rights and entitlements of the majority of people following Sen's meeting. His focus on acquiring certain capabilities for making choices means that we have to examine whether internet sites outside the commercial sphere are supporting the acquisition of the kinds of capabilities that Sen talks about for the majority of people. We need to examine whether these kinds of websites outside the commercial sector actually will allow people to learn and to acquire the abilities to discriminate between alternative choices. Some more empirical evidence. A search of internet websites that are geared to non-commercial life shows that from the health sector to education and on issues of environmental protection or globalization, and indeed anti-globalization, there are, again, a huge number of websites. But the sites that are run by established institutions, governments, education establishments, or development organizations mostly provide people with highly structured, authoritative information, at least in terms of the creators' views. Very, very few of these are set up so that citizens can contribute their own information or indeed acquire the capabilities for deciding how information should be valued or acted upon. Apart from the institutional sites, there are, of course, lots of personal home pages and websites of smaller and larger organizations. The LSE's recent publication of a global civil society report shows that there's some 13,000 of these kinds of organizations, counting only the international ones, scattered all over the world. Many of these have set up websites. Their authoritative status as trusted information intermediaries is established for their members or for those who visit these sites by these organizations. But, and this is crucial, they mainly push information at users. For the most part, they do not provide the means for people to acquire the capabilities, for instance, of making their own information contributions. If we want the internet to support opportunities for citizens to contribute to the democratic process, to support new forms of publicness, then this is the kind of development we need to see more of. Mostly what information intermediaries on the internet do, including those in the public sector and those being developed by civil society organizations, is to keep track of information or to enhance it or to personalize it. But it is basically a kind of a push technological application. Mostly what these new websites are doing is, as I said, to develop authoritative information and make it available. But they do absolutely nothing to address the issues of capabilities in Sen's meaning of the term. Now, lest you think I'm a complete pessimist, I want to talk about what is happening, which could be beneficial. There is a development that does begin to address these issues. This is the free availability of toolkits for producing and sharing information in the public spaces of the internet. There are some, but not very many of these types of websites. For instance, the Internet Scout Project, supported by the National Science Foundation and the Mellon Foundation in the United States, is developing a toolkit that simplifies the technical hurdles involved in creating and sharing web-based information. This is a software package. It allows an individual with a minimum level of technical expertise and resources to set up a website. These new media applications rely on open source software. They are not proprietary products. They also provide access to information that is freely available, and the further use of most of the information is unrestricted by copyright protection. Yet another example of these kinds of sites, and this one is much closer to the LSE, is the London-based Hansard Society's efforts to develop new ways of involving people of all ages and backgrounds in electronic democracy. initiatives using the internet. I could give you more examples. But the point that I want to make is that these initiatives offer people the tools to make contributions to public discussion on the internet, to share information, and to learn how to value that information. These are the types of sites that are necessary if the majority of people in society are to have a chance to acquire the capabilities that are needed in the internet age. Sadly, most of these initiatives are inadequately funded as compared to the websites that offer information mainly to people. They're always struggling to sustain themselves. Yet it is these sites that make the biggest contribution to developing people's capabilities to meet their needs and to participate in an informed dialogue about social choices. Most of the sites being developed by civil society organizations and public organizations are designed to be authoritative information providers in the familiar broadcast or advertising mode. They are not spaces where the majority of people might acquire the capabilities that SEN is concerned about. Research for a master's degree, which was done this summer by one of our media and communication students here at the LSE, confirms this. This student compared the websites of e-government services that are being developed here in Canada and in Australia. He found that they are all using an inflexible model that maximizes the capacity to push authoritative information at people. They hardly begin to provide the tools that would enable citizens to acquire the capabilities to make critical choices about social alternatives. They rarely create opportunities for the majority of people to contribute to public deliberations, apart, that is, from short-lived and moderated discussions on specific issues chosen by the site operators. The under-resourcing of efforts to develop websites and resources for the majority of people to learn how to contribute, to judge the provenance of information, and to make social choices about their own lives must stop. Putting effort into this area ought to be the priority. This is one way in which the new media and the power of networks can be put to work to enable the majority of people to exercise choices and freedoms. Policy aimed at supporting these types of internet developments would constitute a rights-based approach to new media policy, a policy that would have at its core a respect for human rights and the entitlements of human beings. So are there any grounds for optimism? My fourth question about a radical change in new media and internet policy. A pessimist might note that the relationship between technical change and society is a central theme in social science inquiry. But it seems to me that we also have to recognize that the transparency of making social choices in the internet age is even more difficult to maintain now in a world that is fragmented by complex global and local networks. A minority of view of the proper role of the new media is taking precedence, that privileges the publication and dissemination of information at the expense of exchange and critical discourse. This area of policy is a difficult blind spot in our thinking about new media. But I think the internet does have the potential to offer a space for new kinds of dialogues and to forge some new kinds of personal contacts and relationships that are sensitive to the feelings of others. But it cannot be used for this constructively by people if they do not have the capabilities for contributing, for making up their minds about the provenance of information, or about the trust they want to place in the medium's content. The bias in new media favors closed network spaces. It favors broadcast or advertising styles of providing authoritative information. This bias is discouraging other developments like the ones I've mentioned tonight. And yet these are the ones that would help citizens to acquire the capabilities that they need. I'm optimistic, nevertheless, that radical change in new media policy might occur if the policy focus can be shifted to a concern about human rights and people's entitlements. The reason? Well, the new media are very malleable. The internet is encouraging exchanges of new ideas between many people, albeit still a minority, about what this networked world could be useful for. Much more effort could be devoted to policies to support the development of the types of internet tools and sites that I've been talking about. This would help to build up the capabilities of the majority of people to discriminate between alternative social choices. But to achieve this kind of radical change in policy emphasis, some public support for internet developments must be diverted into establishing more of the currently very scarce types of websites. Some of you might want to argue that such direct invention through policy is simply absolutely inconsistent with a libertarian view of the internet. It would mean influencing the internet's development at a time when this should be left to the internet designers and the website developers. Why? In order to encourage experimentation and innovation. But unfortunately, a rights-based approach to future internet developments will not spring from some invisible hand, at least not given the trends in the medium's development. It might also be argued that a rights-based policy to encourage internet developments that enable more people to acquire the capabilities for discriminating between alternative choices could have unintended consequences. It might, for example, heighten the risk that new forms of deliberative processes with greater and potential global participation become unstable, relative, that is, to the problems of governing that already exist today. But policy intervention to mobilize people and funds along the lines I'm suggesting is essential. Inaction is increasing the likelihood that the new media and the power of networks are compounding the problems of governing and the problems of reducing social and economic inequities in many spheres of life. Inaction means that the potential of the new media is not being exploited to address fundamental problems of marginalization and poverty. So to conclude, what follows from SEND's capabilities approach when it's applied to the development of the new media? The first thing that follows is that policy in this area must examine the capabilities that all people are entitled to acquire. As SEND might say, what are the freedoms that people are entitled to in the internet age? The second thing that follows is that rather than putting the majority of our efforts into developing websites that offer authoritative information to people, we start from an assessment of human needs, rights, and entitlements. Too often, our discussions in this area are driven by what technology can do, not by what the majority of people might want to do with it. An alternative approach is essential. One alternative, and it is only one, is public investment in the information websites that make toolkits and other resources available that enable the majority of citizens to acquire the new capabilities. These are the capabilities for cognitive capacities to make critical and informed choices about their people's lives and to participate, if they choose, in new forms of democratic process. The third thing that follows from this capabilities approach is to recognize that it's necessary to evaluate and decide upon what capabilities are necessary. We won't get very far in this if we limit ourselves to talking about conventional capabilities in the business sense, for employment, for the work environment. We will not get very far in this if we wait for the private sector to develop the tools and internet spaces that are needed. It does, I think, fall to the public sector and to civil society organizations to create these opportunities. But even in recognizing this, there needs to be ongoing discussion specifically about what capabilities are required. Evaluation is essential. It doesn't tackle the social exclusion issues directly or the digital divide issues. But it is essential if we are to acknowledge people's entitlements and freedoms to create societies in the manner they choose. This is the reason why we must develop and act upon a rights-based approach to new media policy, a policy that takes advantage of the positive enabling power of global networks. Very short epilogue, if I may. I'd like to thank Nicholas Garnham for his earlier application of Amartya Sen's capabilities approach in the communication field. I'd also like to say that the history and provenance of ideas matters a lot, as you've heard this evening. I wish I had time to acknowledge all the contributors to my thinking, many of whom are here. I do, however, want to acknowledge the contribution to the LSE by the Dixons Group and its chairman, Sir Stanley Combs. Without Sir Stanley's commitment to the school, there wouldn't be a chair in new media. I wouldn't be joining colleagues and students in building a very distinctive program of research and teaching, and I do think we are leading the way in this area. And finally, Professor Giddens, thank you for persisting against my mulish insistence in thinking that the Science Policy Research Unit at Sussex was better than LSE. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much. We've got about 10 minutes to quarter an hour for questions, if anyone should like to ask any. And there are a couple, there's a roving mic downstairs and there's a roving mic upstairs, I believe. So I'll probably leave you to choose your interrogators. I should say the acoustics are not very good laterally in this theatre, even though it's penetrated by the highest technology we could find. It still defeats it, so you have to use the mic well.
Oh, it works. Hi, David Wilcox from a joint UK-US initiative called Making the Network, and I think that all of the things that you were saying were music to the ears of people who have been involved in community networking, community media over the last 10 years, particularly in North America and the UK, but elsewhere. And I wondered if LSE was looking at any ways in which the great repertoire of academic expertise, which you referred to, could be joined with the practical expertise on the ground of those people that have been trying to do the sorts of things that you're talking about for the last 10 years or so.
Well, I hope my LSE colleagues will forgive me if I misspeak, because I haven't been here all that long to know exactly what is going on. I do know, however, that certainly people who are concerned about all kinds of organizations, formal and informal, which fall in the civil society category, are worrying about how theory and practice can come together in order to come up with more applied ways of moving away from the advertising or broadcast model in order to be able to do some of the things which address the key problems or the core problems that I've been talking about.
Gerard Fatlow. The internet obviously overcomes the old problem of there not being more than a limited number of evenings per week, and therefore might be regarded as something that could make for greater democracy. However, does it actually get really fulfill that promise without the interpersonal skills that are learned by debating face to face? Is there a lack there which perhaps will never be filled unless people learn along with these interactive websites and so on the old skills of dialogue? And if that is an important thing, what can be done about it?
I couldn't support what you said more than to really agree with you. I think that face-to-face communication of all kinds remains an absolutely essential way of building and strengthening human relationships for positive outcomes. I think the internet provides an alternative of a kind, but it is only of a kind. And therefore, I think that the two are developing in a complementary way. But my argument in this case is that that complementarity is more to do with the kind of traditional modes of interaction of the old media, in some sense, and the new media in a kind of a one-way, almost a one-way flow mode. And that if we really want interaction, if we really want to be creative about thinking about how human relationships will be forged in the future, we need to worry about both the offline and the online places. That doesn't, however, address the fact that it is true that in this world there are people who do desperately desire to communicate with each other at a distance. And that therefore, if those kinds of dialogues are going to address in even a quasi-rational way some of the fundamental problems of our time, websites should be developed, I think, and invested in, which provide for the kind of learning, even if somewhat inadequate, that enables people to have those discussions at a distance through the internet.
So you're concentrating on the fact that people require certain crucial capabilities to make use of the internet fully. You didn't define what those capabilities are. In fact, you did rather imply that it was up to government policymakers to define those capabilities. But could you please clarify what you have in mind by the capabilities, and therefore what the toolkits you would like to see provided might, at a practical level, provide?
Thank you. I think I was really trying to make two points. The first is that the process of specifying in the way that you mean specifically what capabilities are needed for a rational and critical discourse in the internet age is something that we have made so little progress in even beginning to think about that it would hardly be correct for me to stand up and say there are these, and these. That's one point I'm making. I wouldn't look to governments to define from on high specifically what they are. I think the second point I was trying to make is that there's a need for a much more open and public dialogue and evaluation through time on an ongoing basis as to what those capabilities might be. And then, if you want to push me to stop being quite so ambiguous, I would say that in looking at projects like the Scout project, which I mentioned, one begins to get a feel for not a techie answer, which is, you know, give them toolkits and everything will be all right, but the sensitive development of learning environments and tools which are not simply the kind of ambiguous them out there and here's the intelligent node and you either come to it or you interact with it in some kind of very structured way, but to really beginning to provide opportunities for people to learn how to create their own websites with a minimum of skills, as I said, and that's a set of skills which is somewhat technical, but a minimum, not a maximum, which is what the majority of people have. Also examples of where alternative sources of information are brought together and people are able to assess those, not in a neutral way, but they're able to decide for themselves how much they value that information. And just lastly, one of the examples that I didn't give, which is actually in the written text, is it comes from the Institute of Development Studies at IDS, it's called ID21, the site. And what it does is it brings together, it actively encourages active contributions of information from all over the world, from people. It recognizes where that information has come from, its provenance, and it allows that information to be reused and passed on so that it's possible for citizens, users, whoever comes to that site, to actually have information about the provenance of information and where it's coming from. Those are all skills which you don't learn at ordinary websites. A lot of the time, all you have is the authoritative stamp of the organization that put it there. That's all you know.
You talk about human rights quite a lot in your speech. Can you clarify what you mean by human rights and also policy making, whether you're referring to policy making locally or globally and so forth?
In this case, I'm speaking about a very specific human right to be able to assess and value, to have the capability to assess and value how one wants to live one's life. Relatively speaking, to be able to make improvements. It seems to me that this is a cognitive capacity to comprehend the world around you and make judgments about it. So it's this specific area of human rights that I'm referring to, not all possible human rights. And secondly, in terms of policy, I think the argument I'm making can be applied locally, but can certainly be applied globally as well. In my own case, I spend a great deal of time in the past years weaving my way in and out of intergovernmental organizations in various capacities. And I'm reflecting a lot on the kinds of discussions that go on in these environments, which are about either e-government or electronic commerce or IT for education, etc. And so often, the dominant discourse is about either top-down traditional styles of providing authoritative information to people so that they can learn. That's the assumption. Rather than a much more active, proactive attempt to come to grips with what it would be that the resources, what resources would need to be in place in order for people to come and make their own choices as to what information they want to build up and what they want to learn about their own lives, what critical evaluations they want to make.
One more question.
Hello, Dimitris Bukas from the LSE. I'd like to ask, because you have been speaking about a sort of non-commercial approach to internet with all these sites, educational or other, that would promote capabilities and rights and responsibilities of citizens. I would like to ask to which extent this can coexist with the commercial sides of the commercial side of the internet involving electronic commerce, or we have to speak of a completely non-commercial alternative sort of development of the internet altogether.
I do have views on whether the commercial world of the internet can coexist with open public spaces. That wasn't directly my point tonight, in the sense that what I am saying is that if you look now at the current trends in the development of internet applications, for the most part, in the commercial world, they do seem to be relatively more towards walled spaces, etc. It doesn't make it inevitable that they all will all be, and towards an advertising or broadcast mode of information provision. I therefore decided that, well, if the market, in a sense, is failing to develop at this point in time the types of sites that I think would be much more conducive to the goals I'm talking about, then let's look to the public sector. And when we look to the public sector, what we find is more authoritative information sites being developed in the main. And when we look to the civil society sector, we also find somewhat the same model percolating through people's minds and into the practice of developing websites. And so my argument is that we need to invest in some alternatives, because if we don't, from the public sector, at this point in time in the internet's development, no one else seems to be giving it that much attention. That is not to say that it is absolutely inevitable that the commercial sector never will at all, only to say that the current predominant models are not those which are consistent with the kinds of things I've been talking about.
Turn that last one question, there's one more, I think, and then we have to finish. Well, there are several more, but we apologize to them.
Hello, I'm from an Indian IT company. I head the European operations. My question might be a bit more basic, but we do a lot of very large-scale IT projects, and sometimes I wonder whether the internet, we are going on viewing it as a very different medium from we are seeing all media and the internet. Is the internet really a different medium, or it is just a new way, and it depends more on how we take information and project it correctly? Whether the medium really doesn't matter, whether you use radio, TV, newspapers, press, it's people will reach the information if it's useful information, and more efforts need to be concentrated on sending the right type of information rather than the medium through which the information is sent.
I think the medium matters and it doesn't matter at the same time. The medium matters in the sense that I believe that there is more potential flexibility, more opportunity to think in very creative ways about the use of the internet because of the way it is currently constituted. But I also think it doesn't matter because the judgments about how that medium is going to be used is made very often by transposing what we do in the offline world and trying to make it work in the internet world. This is certainly true in the electronic commerce area, where business models, we talk a lot about new business models, but actually a lot of what is happening is the same commercial practices trying to be squeezed into another medium. When you take education, I think that is less so. I think there has been some movement in the education sector towards thinking more creatively about what the new opportunities are. But again, when we do our surveys of the actual practice, not the experimentation, it's in the lab still, but in the actual practice of what's being provided, we find many of the characteristics that I've been describing when we look systematically at the evidence.
Well, thanks very much. Just in conclusion, can I thank Dixons again for support of this chair, which is a major innovation in the LSE. We want the LSE to be the place for studying the communications industries, and we're well on our way, I think, to achieving that. The need for sociability and getting together was mentioned. Well, there is a reception after this event to which everyone here is invited. That's on the fifth floor of the old building. If you don't know where that is, please follow the crowd, because we'll all be on our way there. Can I say to Robin, sort of late on, welcome to the LSE. We're really pleased to have you here. And thank you for your thoughtful and excellent lecture. Thanks very much.